honor today to introduce to you one of the greatest thinkers of our age, Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse is a very modest man. He really doesn't believe he's very important at all. But I think every word he's written, I won't go through the catalogues of his works, Eros and Civilization, One-Dimensional Man, disproves the modesty that he protests. I think every sentence he utters today will also disprove that. I'd like to introduce to you Herbert Marcuse.
I'm very happy to see so many flowers here, and that is why I want to remind you that flowers by themselves have no power whatsoever other than the power of men and women who protect them and take care of them against aggression and destruction. As a hopeless philosopher, for whom philosophy has become inseparable from politics, I'm afraid I have to give here today a rather philosophical speech, and I must ask your indulgence for it. We are dealing with the dialectic of liberation, actually redundant, because I believe that all dialectic is liberation, and not only liberation in an intellectual sense, but liberation involving the mind and the body, liberation involving the entire human existence. Think of Plato, the liberation from the existence of the cave. Think of Hegel, liberation in the sense of progress and freedom on a historical scale. Think of Marx. Now, in what sense is all dialectic? In this liberation. It is liberation from a repressive, from a bad, from a false system. Be it an organic system, be it a social system, being a mental or intellectual system. Liberation by forces developing within such a system. That is a decisive point. And liberation by virtue of the contradictions generated by the system, precisely because it is a bad, a false system. I'm using intentionally here moral, philosophical terms, values, bad, false. For without the objectively justifiable goal of a better, a free human existence, all liberation must remain meaningless, at best progress in servitude. And even that, I admit, is worth fighting for. I believe that in Marx too, socialism ought to be. This ought belongs to the very essence of scientific socialism. It ought to be. It is, we may almost say, a biological, sociological, and political necessity. A biological necessity, inasmuch as a socialist society, according to Marx, would conform with the very logos of life, with the essential possibilities of a human existence, not only mentally, not only intellectually, but also organically. Now, as to today and our own situation, I think we are faced with a novel situation in history, because today we have to be liberated from a relatively well-functioning, rich, powerful society. I'm speaking here, and my main topic, as you know, is liberation from the affluent societies, that is to say the advanced industrial societies, we are facing the problem, we are facing the need for liberation, not from a poor society, not from a disintegrating society, not even in most cases from a terroristic society, but from a society which develops to a great extent the material and even cultural needs of man, from a society, to use the slogan, which delivers the goods to an ever larger part of the population. And that is, that implies we are facing liberation from a society where liberation is apparently without a mass basis. We know very well the social mechanisms of manipulation, indoctrination, repression, which are responsible for this lack of a mass basis, which are responsible for the integration of the majority of the oppositional forces into the established social system. But I have to emphasize again that this is not merely an ideological integration, that it is not merely a surface integration, that it takes place precisely on the strong and rich basis which enables the society to develop and satisfy material and cultural needs better than before. Now, the knowledge of the mechanisms of manipulation, of repression, which goes down into the very unconscious of man, that is not the whole story. I believe that we, and I will use the we throughout my talk, I believe that we have to be too hesitant, that we have to be ashamed, understandably ashamed, to profess the integral, the radical features of a socialist society, its qualitative difference from all the established societies, its qualitative difference by virtue of which socialism is indeed and can be the definite negation of the established systems, no matter how productive, no matter how powerful they are or they may appear. In other words, and that is one of the many points where I disagree with Paul Goodman, our fault was not that we have been too immodest, but that we have been too modest. We have been too modest, we have, as it were, repressed a great deal of that, what we should have said and what we should have emphasized. If today these integral features, these truly radical features, which make a socialist society the definite negation of the existing societies, if this qualitative difference today appears as utopian, as idealistic, as metaphysical, this is precisely the form in which these radical features must appear if they are really to be the definite negation of the established societies, if socialism is indeed the rupture of history, the radical break, the leap into the realm of freedom, a total rupture. One illustration how this awareness or half-awareness of the need for such a total rupture was present in some of the great social struggles of our period. Walter Benjamin quotes reports that during the Paris Commune, in all corners of the city of Paris, there were people shooting at the clocks on the towers of the churches, palaces, and so on, thereby consciously or half-consciously expressing the need that somehow time has to be arrested, that at least the prevailing, the established time continuum has to be arrested, and that a new time has to begin. A very strong emphasis on the qualitative difference and on the totality of the rupture between the new societies and the old. Now, in this sense, I should like to discuss here today with you the repressed prerequisites of qualitative change. I say intentionally of qualitative change, not of revolution, because we know of too many revolutions through which the continuum of repression has been sustained, which have replaced one system of domination by another system of domination. We must become aware of the essentially new features which distinguish a free society as the definite negation of the established societies, and we must begin formulating these features, no matter how metaphysical, no matter how utopian, I even say no matter how ridiculous, we may appear to the normal people in all camps, on the right as well as on the left. What is the dialectic of liberation with which we are here concerned? It is the construction of a free society, a construction which depends on the prevalence of the vital need for abolishing the established systems of servitude, and which depends, secondly, and that is decisive, on the vital commitment, the striving, conscious as well as sub and unconscious, for the qualitatively different values of a free human existence. Without the emergence of such new needs and satisfaction, the new needs and satisfaction of free men, all change in the social institutions, no matter how great, no matter how large, would only replace one system of servitude by another system of servitude. Nor can the emergence, and I should like to emphasize this, nor can the emergence of such new needs and satisfactions be envisaged as a mere byproduct, the mere result of changed social institutions. We have seen that, that is a fact of experience. For the development of the new institutions must already be carried out and carried through by men with the new needs. That is, by the way, the basic idea underlying Marx's own concept of the proletariat as a historical agent of revolution. He saw in the industrial proletariat the historical agent of revolution, not only because it was a basic class in the material process of production, not only because it was at that time the majority of the population, but also because this class was free from, in quotation marks, the repressive and aggressive competitive needs of capitalist society, and therefore, at least potentially, the carrier of essentially new needs, goals, and satisfactions. We can formulate this dialectic of liberation also in a more brutal way as a vicious circle. The transition from voluntary servitude, as it exists to a great extent in the affluent society, to freedom presupposes the abolition of the institutions and mechanisms of suppression, and the abolition of the institutions and mechanisms of suppression already already presupposes liberation from servitude, prevalence of the need for liberation. As to the need, I think we have to distinguish between the need for changing intolerable conditions of existence and the need for changing the society as a whole. The two are by no means identical and are by no means in harmony. Quantitative change, if the need is for changing intolerable conditions of existence, with at least a reasonable chance that this can be achieved within the established society, with the growth and the progress of the established society. Quantitative change. Qualitative change, change of the very system as a whole. I would like to point out that the distinction between quantitative and qualitative change is not identical with the distinction between reform and revolution. Quantitative change can mean and can lead to revolution. Only the conjunction, I suggest, of these two is revolution in the essential sense of the leap from prehistory into the history of man. Or the problem with which we are faced is to determine the point where quantity can turn into quality, where the quantitative change in the conditions and institutions can become a qualitative change affecting the entire human existence. Today, the two potential factors of revolution, which I have just mentioned, are disjoint. The first is most prevalent in the undeveloped countries, where quantitative change, that is to say the creation of human living conditions, is in itself qualitative change, but is not yet freedom. The second potential factor of revolution, the prerequisites of liberation, are potentially there in the advanced industrial countries, but are contained and perverted by the capitalist organization of society. I think we are faced with a situation in which this advanced capitalist society has reached the point where quantitative change can technically be turned into qualitative change, into authentic liberation. And it's precisely against this truly fatal possibility that the affluent society, that advanced capitalism, is mobilized and organized on all fronts, in the interior as well as abroad. Before I go on, let me give you a brief definition of what I mean by an affluent society, a society which even in the United States is not yet entirely translated into reality. I would prefer to speak of tendencies here, but of course the model is the American society today. In the first place, it shouldn't be necessary to remind us of it. It is a capitalist society. It seems to be necessary because there are some people even on the left who believe that the American society is no longer a class society. I can assure you it is a class society. It is a capitalist society with a high concentration of economic and political power, with an enlarging sector of automation and coordination of production, distribution, and communication, with private ownership in the means of production, which, however, depends increasingly on ever more divine intervention by the government. It is a society in which, as I mentioned, the material as well as cultural needs of the underlying population are satisfied on a scale larger than before, but satisfied in line with the requirements and interests of the apparatus and of the powers which control the apparatus. And it is a society growing under conditions of accelerating waste, planned obsolescence and destruction, while the substratum of the population continues to live in poverty and misery. I believe that these factors are internally interrelated, that they make out the syndrome of late capitalism, namely the apparently inseparable unity, inseparable for the system, of productivity and destruction, of satisfaction of needs and repression, of liberty within a system of servitude, namely subjugation of man to the apparatus, and the inseparable unity of rational and irrational. We can say that the rationality of the society lies in its very insanity, and that the insanity of the society is rational to the degree to which it is efficient, to the degree to which it is efficient, to the degree to which it delivers the goods. Now the question we must raise is, why liberation from such a society, if it is capable of, perhaps in a long future, but apparently capable of conquering poverty to a greater degree than before, of reducing the toil of labor and the time of labor, and of raising the standard of living. Why liberation from such a society, if the price for all the goods delivered, if the price for this comfortable servitude, for all these achievements, is exacted from people far away from the metropolis and far away from its affluence, if the affluent society itself hardly notices what it is doing, how it is spreading terror, enslavement, how it is fighting liberation in all corners of the globe. We know the traditional weakness of emotional, moral, and humanitarian arguments in the face of such a technological achievement, in the face of the irrational rationality of such a power. These arguments do not seem to carry any weight against the brute facts, we can say brutal facts, of this society and its productivity. And yet, it is only the insistence on the real possibility of a free society, which is blocked by the affluent society, it is only this insistence, in practice as well as in theory, in discussion as well as in demonstration, it is only this insistence which still stands in the way of the complete degradation of man to an object, or rather subject-object, of total administration. It is only this insistence which stands still in the way of the progressing brutalization and moronization of man. For, and I should like to emphasize it, the capitalist welfare state is a warfare state. It must have an enemy, with a capital E, a total enemy, because the perpetuation of servitude, the perpetuation of the miserable struggle for existence, in the very face of the new possibilities of freedom, This activates and intensifies in this society primary aggressiveness to a degree I think hitherto unknown in history, a primary aggressiveness which must be mobilized in socially useful ways lest it explode the system itself. Therefore, the need of an enemy who must be there, and he must be created, even if he does not exist. Fortunately, I dare say the enemy does exist, but his image and his power must in this society be inflated beyond all proportions in order to be able to mobilize this aggressiveness of the affluent society in socially useful ways. The result is a mutilated, crippled and frustrated human existence, a human existence which is violently defending its own servitude.